Hey guys, it's Albert. We got a great show coming to you live from Indianapolis this week. We have got a fantastic guest coming in to discuss the number one quarterback in the 2020 draft. We've got the takeaways off the top, and as always, we wrap things up with all your questions in the mailbag. Let's go. Welcome in. We are live from Indianapolis. I'm in my hotel room right now. I'll be back, going back over to the Combine in a little bit. It is Wednesday. It is Combine week. Draft speculation, draft talk is ramping up. And, of course, everything else to go with the NFL offseason is coming at you, too. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. We got a great guest coming for you. We're going to answer your questions in the six-pack, but I'm going to start with my takeaways. And I want to go through this somewhat quick because I know a lot of you guys aren't all that excited by labor talk, but it looks like the ball's starting to roll in the CBA. Tuesday night here in Indianapolis, the NFL met with the NFLPA. The NFLPA's player reps were at a nearby hotel as their executive committee met with the NFL CEC. There weren't any real fundamental changes to the deal that was on the table at the end of last week, but they did meet for almost 4 hours in a hotel in downtown Indianapolis. And then just after midnight, the player reps voted to recommend the new CBA to the larger group of players, and now almost 2,000 players will vote on whether or not to ratify the CBA. And I think the simplest way you can boil this down without getting lost in the numbers of the whole thing, if they were looking to do a deal that was just, let's keep making money, let's get rich, this accomplishes that. The numbers are better than they were in the old CBA. You're going from 47% to 48%. My understanding is to hit the kicker to get yourself to 48.5% isn't going to be that difficult, and so you're going to make more money. One owner told me that the salary cap could be at $260-270 million within 3 years. You're going to be inching closer to $300 million. This allows the NFL to go hammer out the television deals. That's a big deal for the owners because they feel like the market could be affected by the election. Bernie Sanders gets elected. I know this sounds crazy, but a lot of the owners are fearful that if Bernie Sanders even gets the nomination, it's going to affect the markets, which is going to have to affect how people do business. And, of course, the ratings, they're anticipating their general hit that they take when it's an election year in the ratings. The ratings won't be quite what they were last year. And so they're in a sweet spot to do a television deal right now. They need to get the CBA done first to really optimize what they're able to do with the television deals. Television deals then set the stage for them to go and monetize gambling. Within 3 or 4 years, their expectation is 35 or 40 states are going to have legalized gambling, which is going to allow them to better leverage what they can with a sport that's perfect for gambling. And so this is one of those deals where the owners are now set up to make a lot more money and the players are set up to get a bigger take of it. So from that standpoint, there is an everyone wins element to this, and it did make sense to do a deal now. On the other side of it, if you are looking for a game changer, if you are looking to catch up with baseball or basketball, if you're the union, that didn't really happen. And a lot of the fundamental pieces of the old CBA are still in place. Franchise tags. It takes 4 years for players to vest. It's not easy to get to free agency. Franchise tags are still there again after you vest. And so for a non-first-round pick, it can take you 6 years to get to free agency. For a first-round pick, it can take you 7 years to get there. There have been certain changes to rookie contracts, the way the options work, but for the most part, those are still where they are. To me, like the one sort of rule that's in place that sort of shows the strength of the owners and how hard they are to negotiate is the funding rule remaining in place. And that is a rule that was set up actually when teams weren't solvent and when players had to worry whether or not their next paycheck was coming. And so, you know, that rule requires NFL teams to fund every fully guaranteed dollar that they commit to a player, which, you know, in 2020 has been used as a crutch to not give players full guarantees. The funding rule was changed a little bit where you can fully guarantee up to $15 million on your salary cap, but after that, you got to fund every dollar, which does, again, doesn't make sense and is going to continue to be used as a crutch for teams to not guarantee contracts. And so fundamentally, the way the game is set up, the way player movement works, the way contracts work, none of that stuff's changing. But, you know, if your goal was, let's continue to make money, let's make things more comfortable on players, then yeah, this is a fine deal. You can of course make the argument that the owners didn't really give up anything that they didn't want to give up, and this wasn't really an uncomfortable deal for them to do. And I think that's all true. But the players do walk away with a bigger take. And I think you got to give DeMora Smith and Eric Winston credit for that, especially after we saw the CBA of 2011 mature the way that it did, and players getting more money towards the end of the deal. After the first two or three years, the deal came under a lot of criticism. Takeaway number two, Tom Brady and Bill Belichick need to sit down. And I feel stronger about that than I did a week ago, than I did 2 weeks ago. And here's the reason why. No matter how many times Bill Belichick, Nick Caserio, whoever it is from the Patriots side, meet with Don Yee, Steve Dubin, Brady's agents, there are still certain things that I think Brady and Belichick have to hash out on their own. I believe, in fact, I'm told that Brady is willing to come back to New England under certain terms. I'm additionally told that Bill Belichick is amenable to bringing Tom Brady back under certain terms. So what has to happen now is one side needs to meet with the other side, and they need to figure out whether or not they can make their terms mesh. If they can, then I think a deal could get done. If they can't, then we're talking about something else. And some of this is going to boil down to how Belichick's going to build the team from the defensive side of the ball, where you've got, you know, a group of 11 starters last year where nine of those guys are going to be 29 or older by opening day 2020. You've got older pieces on offense. Julian Edelman's 34. Marcus Cannon's going to be 32. Julian Edelman's going to be 34. There's just a lot of big decisions that the Patriots have to make here, and a lot of it's going to relate to whether or not they bring back Brady. And so I think Brady wants a picture of what the Patriots are going to look like in 2020 if he comes back. I think the Patriots need to know who their quarterback's going to be so they can start to plan for 2020. So really, I think a lot of this is going to require Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, the greatest coach of all time, the greatest player of all time, sitting down and figuring out whether or not one man's terms can mesh with another man's terms. Okay, takeaway number three, the Burrow versus Tua debate. You know, the more people I talk to, the more real I think this is from a player standpoint, but I do not believe that there's going to be much of an argument when it comes to who's going to go first. And there's a very specific reason why. Now, Burrow had the better single year. He's had a better single year than maybe any quarterback in college football history had last year. Tua's obviously got more tape. But I think from a player's playing standpoint, you know, it sort of depends on what you want in your quarterback. There's not a massive chasm between the two. To me, the difference is in durability. And this stuff really matters. And I'm going to explain to you exactly why this matters. If you look at the course of the last decade, just about every quarterback who came into the league with significant injury history and went in the first round wound up getting hurt again. Sam Bradford in 10, Jake Locker in 11, Robert Griffin in 12, Marcus Mariota in 15, Carson Wentz in 16, Deshaun Watson in 17. All of them, every single one of them, wound up getting hurt again. And you could even, you know, throw Josh Rosen in the bucket. So there's just so much history there where durability, I think, is it's just a very real thing with quarterbacks. Guys who have history getting hurt have tended to continue to get hurt. And so, to me, that's really what separates Burrow and Tua. Now, both those guys are going to sit out throwing drills on Thursday night at Lucas Oil Stadium. Burrow, because, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this with our guest, Burrow, because his season went deep into January, and he didn't feel like he'd be able to put his best foot forward right now. And Tua Tagovailoa, of course, because he's got the hip injury, he's planning to throw his pro day on April 9th. Topic number four, takeaway number four, Dak should not take less. I think this much is obvious. To me, I look at the market for quarterbacks where it's gone, and you know there was a string there where guys kept topping one another. It went from Andrew Luck to Derek Carr to Jimmy Garoppolo to, I believe, Matthew Stafford to Matt Ryan to Aaron Rodgers, to Russell Wilson. I may be missing one or two in there, but there was a string there. Kirk Cousins was in there too. There was a string there where it was one after another. They kept topping one another. And, you know, we're right now at the point where the next quarterback is going to get closer to $40 million. Patrick Mahomes, I think, will break $40 million. And so Dak should be in that category. This is his first chance at life-changing money. He was a fourth-round pick, and he's taken on all the injury risk now. That's what's important to remember here. When a team does a deal early, they're buying back some of the injury risk from the players, right? So I think that that piece of it, when you if you were the player and you went to your the final year of your deal, you're saying to yourself, okay, I got to make it through 16 games. When you make it through those 16 games, now you've shouldered the injury risk. You've taken it off the team, where going into that final year, if they sign you, then they're taking on the injury risk. And so, look, this is just what the market bears. I don't think Dak's going to hurt other players by taking more. I mean, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. And with the cap going up the way that it could, I'm not sure we're going to look at $40 million for a quarterback the same way we do now in, say, 2023. Finally, takeaway number five, the trade market, I believe, will be active at the top of the first round after talking to some people. And I think Tua getting healthy is what's going to drive that. So chances are right now, Joe Burrow goes first overall to the Bengals. Chances are right now, Chase Young goes second overall to the Redskins. And that puts the Detroit Lions in a great position to deal away the third overall pick. And in a great position not only to deal away the third overall pick, but also to walk away with one of the premier defensive players in this year's draft. And if you look at the top group, now they're probably not getting Chase Young, but you've also got Jeff Okuda, you've got Derek Brown, and you've got Isaiah Simmons there. And so if only one of those players is off the board after three picks, that means at least one of those players is going to be available at six. At five and six, you've got the Dolphins and you've got the Chargers. Both those teams need quarterbacks. And so I just think we've got a fascinating situation here developing it near the top of the draft, where you're going to have the team at three in Detroit and maybe even the team at four in the Giants with an ability to sort of shuffle around, pick up some extra picks, and still get a premier defensive player. So Tua getting at least, I think, as good a medical report as he could have gotten, during the physicals, that helps. And certainly, I think if Justin Herbert were to get hot, that would drive the market even more. So we had an interesting couple months ahead when it comes to all of that. And now let's get to our special guest. All right, everybody who listens to the show is familiar with this guest. He's come on with us a bunch. One of the best guys when it comes to training young quarterbacks. Going back to when they're teenagers all the way until they're ready to get prepared for the NFL draft. He's a former NFL quarterback himself. You can hear him on Fox in the fall calling college games. Jordan Palmer, welcome in.
Oh, thanks for having me, man. Love it.
Okay, so here's where we're going to start. I'm going to go back. I'm going to wind the clock all the way back. I think it was like June, July. Every year I do this project kind of like looking forward at the next year's quarterbacks. And so Jordan's one of the guys that I bring in as an expert on these guys because he's known a lot of these guys since they were teenagers. And I'm going to read what you read about Joe Burrow. LSU is one of those teams, when you play them, you see it's built on good play at every other position but quarterback. But the last five games, and you're talking about 2018 here, he went off. And they're bringing back pass rushers, corners, three good running backs. It's all there. He has a chance to have a special year, and you can see it's not too big for him. Did you know something about Joe Burrow back then in June and July that maybe you weren't letting on?
Yeah, I knew he was going to throw 60 touchdowns, win the Heisman, and go number one. to be honest, I saw something different, but it wasn't just my eyes on it. So I run QB Summit camps, and it's camps that anybody can come to from as young as 11 or 12 through seniors in high school. But I bring in college counselors. Part of it is I'm training them, and part of it is they get to train the younger players. Well, and then a lot of the summits, my NFL veteran guys come back. So I had one particular summit, and I think it was in June, out in Southern California. Joe Burrow was one of the college counselors. Bo Nix was one of the counselors, a handful of other guys. But Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, Kyle Allen, three guys that live in the offseason down the street from me, and I'm just training them right now and train them all offseason, they were at that summit. And Joe got in later at night, and all the guys were staying at Sam Darnold's beach house. And Joe and those three guys sat around a fire pit talking, and I was in the house talking to other guys, and they all kind of said something to me afterwards, and they said, hey, what do you know about this Burrow kid? And I go, not much. I mean, talked to Coach Orgeron about him. I watched the second half of the season. I was super impressed. Why? And they said, if this dude can throw it at all, he's special because he's really confident and he really knows football. And so the next day I was excited to watch him throw and he looked great. And then you start learning about the pieces that he had, what he was saying about Justin Jefferson and what he thought about, you know, the running back and some of these other skill positions, Jamar Chase and the tight end Moss. And you just assume that all these other positions, I mean, where they got 16 guys in Indy right now. I mean, that's almost normal. It's, I mean, LSU recruits dudes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
And then the statement that you read, you know, they have dudes at every position. It's just quarterback's been a void for them since my year, which was Jamarcus.
Right.
Ironically, the last time they had somebody was when I came out. And you start to go, man, well, wait a second. This is actually like a national championship team. Mm-hmm. If this Burrow kid's the real deal. And the more conversations I had with him during training camp and obviously during the season, but really just building up to the season, I was able to kind of sit there and see what kind of the writing on the wall.
What surprised you then on what you saw? And I should be clear here, you know, Jordan's working with Joe now to get him ready for the draft and everything else. Did anything surprise you? Because no one can predict, right? 16 touchdowns, six picks.
Of course not.
But, I mean, was there anything that really kind of jumped out at you as like, wow, I didn't expect this or I didn't expect that?
Nothing. You know, when I work with guys, it's like we're on the driving range.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's perfect weather, it's t-shirts and shorts, there's nobody tackling anybody. And so you can only see so much, right? And some people look amazing on the driving range and can't play. Mm-hmm. And some guys just look whatever on the driving range and they're ballers on Sundays and Saturdays. And so you never really can tell. But one of the things that I noticed, even just through the first and second game of the season, is that everything that happened on the field translated on the driving range translated to the course. And so a perfect example is you cannot find a clip from this last year of Joe Burrow moving around and not having two hands on the ball. Something so simple like that, right? I trained Sam Darnold for the draft, and if you remember back then, the number one stigma with Sam Darnold was he was a fumbler. He had nine fumbles at USC his junior year, right? So I'm big on mechanics and all your cleats in the ground, keeping a good base and nothing, you know, that's groundbreaking and never been heard before. But I can't find too many clips of this dude's feet not being exactly where he wanted him to be. I can't find any clips of this guy moving outside the pocket and not having his eyes downfield. I can't see this. I don't have any clips of this guy forcing balls into windows that weren't there or predetermining. So I think the biggest thing about Joe is everything that he does and he learns and he absorbs, it translates to games and it translates to big games against big competition.
So that says he's coachable, right? Like that basically, that's he's not only able to.
I think coachable is an understatement. I mean, you're right, but I'm saying like it's coachable. But there's another level that he's on right now where, for example, okay, so one of the things I do with college guys, any coaches out there, steal this, okay? So before a guy's last year, his contract year of college, I call it, okay? So for Sam, that was his junior year. For Joe, that was his senior year, right? For guys in their contract year, I did this with Drew Lock last year. And Daniel Jones, the 2 years before that, Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, whatever. Before that, I did it with Deshaun and Mahomes. Mm-hmm. So what I do is I say in spring ball, because these guys aren't in a quarterback competition, right?
Right.
In spring ball, give me one good reason why you can't complete 90% of your passes. And if it hits them in the face and they drop it, that's a catch, okay? So 10% of your balls shouldn't get batted down or be misses, right? Those are talking about a pretty good data set here, a lot of throws. So give me one good reason why you can't be 90%. And the reality is they can't. They can't come up with one. And so I said, well, then you got to look at it and think about when you complete it. I learned something from Mark Trestman, who ironically is in the XFL now, but he's the smartest coach I was ever around. And Mark used to say, every single completion has a negative effect on the defense. Mm-hmm. So think about it. When I complete a ball for 5 yards, everybody on defense is doing one of two things. They're sprinting at a pursuit angle, or they're getting yelled at for not sprinting at a pursuit angle, right? Everybody on offense, if that ball's incomplete, everybody on defense stops, recovers, and gets the personnel grouping and the play that they want in,
right?
So completions, negative effect. You talk to guys in spring ball, ask any college quarterback in the country, hey, what do you guys? What's the goal in spring? One of the first things they're gonna say is, we got some young guys we gotta bring along, right? Well, what's the best way to bring them along? If a freshman has one catch in practice or six catches in practice?
Right.
So the mindset can't be, if I have curl flat, can't be, I really wanna throw this curl, I'm gonna force it in there. It has to be, If the flat's open, I'm taking it because the completion is more valuable. The other piece here is it's really the only meaningful stat in spring ball. They don't track yards. They don't track touchdowns. Yeah, they track picks, but whatever, a little misleading. As much 7-on-7 as you do. The only thing that really matters is completion. So here's the deal. Every one of my guys goes from 60-something to 80-something just by adjusting their mentality.
Right.
And that is Deshaun, Locke, Jones, Stidham. I mean, literally across the board, all these guys, their contract year of college, their last year of college, they all went from 60-something to 80-something. Joe went to 90, and then it all translated to the season because he was 0.02% away from breaking the completion percentage record.
Because that's like another level of learning too, right? Because that's not just being able to like kind of take in the lesson, it's being able to apply it, right? Like, which is like...
In the SEC versus seven top 10 teams, you know what I mean? Like, whatever it was, it's like, it's I don't know what it is. It's impressive. It's not just coachability though. Like, you're right, but it's just whatever the level above coachability is.
Right. So... Right. That would indicate.
Like people ask me like, what translates the most for Joe? That long story. You know what I mean? Like that.
Yeah. So it's like is there? So that, I mean, but that would indicate that he still has a lot of room to grow.
Totally. Right. Yeah.
Because
he's got a long ways to go.
He's going to get new. He's going to get more coaching, and he's going to be able to apply all of that. And I assume a player like that could like continue to tighten up what he does, right?
Well, think about this. Okay, so there's a misconception right now that he played in this NFL system because Joe Brady came from the Saints and he's probably running exactly what Sean Payton runs. No, they didn't. They were in five-man protection from week four on. They were in a five-man protection. So that means only the five O-linemen are blocking. Your running back and your tight end, they're out, free releasing. Okay, that means you have five guys in the route. Joe's got to play quarterback. The other five guys are blocking. So they're in five-man protection basically every snap. From game four on.
Right.
Okay. Now, these SEC teams were dialing things up. They were actually even saying, we're going to bring the house. We know that guy over there is going to be left open.
Right.
Like, they were trying everything, right? Georgia came out and did something they'd never done before, and Tennessee did this other thing, and Florida did this one thing, whatever, right? My point is that Joe saw every single look that you could possibly get against a five-man protection. Obviously, the defenses are going into the game knowing they're going to be in five-man protection. Well, they didn't really run six or seven-man protection. He's going to run more six-man protection probably than anything in the league, and he's going to run a lot of seven-man protections too. So I look at it and I go, well, that's just a matter of time until he masters six and seven-man protections too. But right. It's not going to be this thing where you go, well, he never really did six-mans in college. He probably can't learn it.
Yeah.
It's the opposite. So when you give this guy a full arsenal, I've said this about a couple of players. I said this about Patrick Mahomes, mm-hmm. who was amazing in college. Cliff Kingsbury introduced me to him when he was a sophomore. And I said this about Deshaun Watson, who right after the Dabo Sweeney, Michael Jordan comment, what I said, I agree, this is Michael Jordan. Joe is going to be a better pro than college player. Now, it sounds crazy because he had the most historic season ever. Here's my reasoning. If the guy is capable, for example, Deshaun Watson, it was not noted until I started chirping at the draft that he is one of the most studious, detail-oriented, note-taker, discipline, competitive learners.
Right.
Forget football, just learning. He was on honor roll in third grade, graduated on the dean's list in less than 3 years. Deshaun's not known for this, okay? So when I said that he's going to be a better pro than college player, what I meant was, they ran a very basic system at Clemson. They still do. If you give him, instead of saying, hey, go from one to two and then run if it's not there, in the NFL, Bill O'Brien will give him a run pass check with me. The run goes to the shade unless they're in a bare front or they have strong rotation into the run. And the pass play, we're going to go ahead and it's going to be a six-man protection, but we're going to go away from rotation. Cloud will go left. Quarters will go right. There's a two-man alert. But if they go all-out cover zero, we're going to check to this. Deshaun can handle all of that. So if you give him that when he walks out of scrimmage, he's got more opportunities to get his team in the right play.
Yeah.
Same thing with Joe.
Right.
You give him multiple plays, check with me's, multiple looks, he's going to have a higher likelihood of succeeding, right? And so that's why I can say Joe will be better in the NFL than college because he'll be given more and he can do more with that.
Is there something like physically, like I remember talking about Deshaun a few years ago and obviously Darnold. Is there something that's, you sort of hit on it already. Something else, I guess, then outside of just his ability to learn and apply his lessons, Is there something that separates him, just having watched him and worked with him, from the other guys? Not saying one's better than the other,
yeah.
But I know everybody's good at one thing and maybe not as good as something else.
Yeah, and you can't – it's not even that I won't say who the best is, or in my opinion who the best is. Like, it just depends on the situation so much, right?
Yeah.
But what I will say is that I can – my eye – when I'm evaluating quarterbacks, so I get all this stuff notarized. I've been right for the last couple of years here.
Yeah.
On the guys that were turned out good and the guys that didn't.
Right.
And so what my eye goes to first, I talked to a lot of GMs about this, is two things, confidence and maturity. Mm-hmm. Now, they're hard to rank, right? And they can do psychological tests and all that stuff, but you kind of have to have access to them,
right?
As you mentioned, some of these guys have been around since they're little, right?
Right.
I met Tua when he was a sophomore in high school.
Yeah.
So confidence and maturity. Mm-hmm. And those are things where I think there's a gap in both of those categories between Joe and anybody else I've been around. From a confidence standpoint, it's not better than Deshaun's. It's just different.
Right.
It's just so rock solid and certain. And then on the maturity side, this guy's 23. He's got his master's. He's got a serious girlfriend. He knows exactly who he is. And then if you think about all the newness in his life, okay, and so everyone thinks that Joe came out of nowhere this year, right? And he did. He was a good, great high school player. He went to Ohio State, right?
Right.
I mean, like, they don't take scrubs at quarterback there,
yeah.
Right? But all the newness with Joe, you think about it, it's really been in the last 2 months. So he goes and starts the season, they're 2-0, 3-0, 4-0, 5-0. Well, he's kind of finishing his master's. So really, he just went from his dorm room to the facility. He just not like he was running around campus.
Right.
Right? And
right.
Running around classes and undergrad. Yeah. So he basically was sheltered. He just kind of went to the facility, did ball all day long, handled his schoolwork, obviously, his master's, and then went back. And he doesn't go out. He hangs out with his girlfriend. He hangs out with his roommates, right? So the season's going nuts, and everyone's paying attention, and he just kind of at the facility, right? So it wasn't really until you got to the playoffs, all the press conferences and all the hype.
There's like an extra,
Then the championship, then the Heisman, then or whatever the order is. Right, then all this stuff. So I would argue that his whole star that just completely exploded and shot into the sky has really only been happening for the last 2 months. And I am, speaking of the maturity, unbelievably impressed with him going from completely irrelevant to pandemonium everywhere he goes. Even where we're training in California, there's random autograph people popping up at the high school. We have to get security to meet him. I'm at a random Catholic school that there's a bunch of NFL guys training there all day. I've never seen an autographed guy there.
Right.
It's pandemonium everywhere he goes, and he's just handled it like a 42-year-old dude who's been doing this for 30 years.
So how does he handle it? Like,
it's confidence and maturity, and it's just this strange concoction of the two of them that I just haven't seen before.
Okay, so obviously you played for the Bengals. Your brother played for the Bengals. What are you telling Joe about Cincinnati? They've obviously got the number one pick. He said yesterday, I'm going to play for whoever drafts me. He's obviously from 2 hours from there. You and your brother both have a lot of history there. What would you tell Joe if he asked, and I'm assuming he has, about the Bengals?
Yeah, I think, well, one, time changes a lot of things, right? I mean, there's a whole entire staff.
Yeah.
That's completely changed since I was there. You know, I'm very close with Marvin and a lot of those guys, Hugh Jackson, Ken Zampezi's, you know, now he's in Washington. He was our quarterback coach and the coordinator there for a little bit. And I mean, there's a couple of pieces. I think the special teams coordinator's still there. I think Paul Sparling's still the trainer. You know what I mean? Like different strength coach. So to be honest, like my experience there's kind of irrelevant.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I can tell him what Paul Brown Stadium's like and you know what I mean? But I just don't have a lot of, and people are connecting the dots on me and Carson and training Joe and how that's complete speculation.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't have it's been 7 years since I've been there or something like that.
Right.
So I don't really have a lot of meaningful advice or counsel on it. It's more or less just helping him get ready for his rookie year. If that's them, he's going to roll. If it's someone else, he's going to roll. So it's just, I stay in my lane. I'm trying to help him get ready for his rookie year.
Mm-hmm.
And him and his agents have a process to go through. They're going through that, and he's handling every step of this the right way. Even the tweet yesterday about his small hands, like, he's just not super concerned with what people think, but always respectful. And I think that's a really cool combination.
Yeah, he's got like a good sense for the moment. It feels like,
totally.
like handling something like that.
He does,
like,
definitely doesn't take himself very serious, which is awesome, and it's why he's a magnet and people love him.
How, like, so just speaking in general terms then, with the guys you've worked with, I look at like Patrick Mahomes, right? Like, probably would have been great no matter what. But he goes to a place with Andy Reid. He had Matt Nagy his first year. He's had Bieniemy the last couple of years. He has I mean, two big money tackles in Eric Fisher and Mitch Schwartz. He's got Tyreek Hill. He's got Sammy Watkins. This year he had Mecole Hardman. He's got Travis Kelce. You know, you look at Carson Wentz, you know, early success in Philly. Two great tackles, great tight ends. Doug Peterson, Frank Reich, you know, John DeFilippo. Like, so it's a long way of asking, like, how important is the situation that a young quarterback goes into?
It's everything.
Yeah.
It really is everything. What they ask you to do. Because here's the thing, connecting it back to Cincinnati, like, when Carson got there, it was a great situation.
Yeah.
He sat his whole rookie year behind, I think, one of the top five all-time greatest quarterbacks to groom a high pick.
The guy who's a coach now.
John
yeah.
Kitna.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Sam Darnold
was
with Josh McCown, who's number one on my list, by the way.
Okay.
Greatest older veteran quarterbacks to teach you how to be a professional.
So how can you not learn? Yeah.
And so Carson, you know, and they were 8-8, and Kitna was comeback player of the year that year, and they had Ocho and TJ coming in, which was a seventh round pick find that they found. You know what I mean? It's not like everybody was on TJ Houshmandzadeh. Nobody was. And so I just think, you know, I don't know a ton about Cincinnati's situation. I don't know a ton about, I didn't watch them a ton this year. They had, you know, Andy got benched and the line struggled from what I know and the Baltimore was rolling and you know what I mean? So it's just one of those years. But I think, you know, as Joe enters into this, you'd love to have a great O-line, a really good run game, a really good tight end, receivers that can create separation, and a defense that gets off the field on third down. Like, those are the things that you want, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, great ownership and great teams can build that around a quarterback. I think from my viewpoint, most of the teams in the league have done that before. And and it's just it's a timing thing. And that's why this is such a team sport and there's so many moving pieces. But I with Cincinnati, no idea. I mean, Zach Taylor's been a head coach for 1 year.
Right.
Who knows? He could be an offensive genius with the right pieces in place. It's just a matter of time.
So, all right, like before we get into the other quarterbacks, last thing on Joe. In 5 years, what do you think we're saying about him?
That's a great question.
Because it's interesting because he's like kind of like I said, like maybe third, fourth round pick. That's why most people saw him over the summer, right? Like, and now he's become this.
Oh, maybe. I was here in sixth. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, obviously the ascent's been, you know, and obviously there are circumstances at Ohio State with the broken hand and everything else. But, you know, Haskins is ahead of him. He transfers. He goes to LSU. Good, not great.
Yeah.
Junior year. Senior year blows up. What's the five-year curve here? Like, what do you think we're saying about him in 5 years?
Well, in high school, the program wasn't very good when he started, and they lost in the championship game. He'll tell you detailed exactly what happened, how the game lost. He's like got a McVay memory. It's well documented what happened at LSU.
Right.
Right. No one was picking them to win anything.
Yeah.
And then they won the national championship. I think wherever he goes, if it's Cincinnati, if it's somebody else, I think he turns the place around.
Yeah.
So I think what we say in 5 years is this guy initiates movements.
Right.
That's what happened at LSU. It's a movement.
Yeah.
It's not a wave. It's not a really like a spike or a really exciting time in LSU history. It's bigger than that. It's a movement. It's going when he leaves, who knows who the quarterback's gonna be there, right?
Yeah.
But one, I bet you some top high school quarterbacks are gonna wanna go there, and I bet you some grad transfers are gonna wanna transfer there. Aside from that, these players who are staying, Ja'Marr Chase and these guys, like they're going to pick off where they left off. Joe's not going to play for the Tigers next year, but that's going to be a movement.
He raised the bar.
Yes.
The bar
just changed the way that everyone looked at things.
Right.
And so I think he's going to come into the NFL. He's going to do the same thing. He's going to have no problem talking to a 34-year-old and telling him how to do it. And so I think in 5 years, we're going to go, man, I can't believe he turned that place around.
Okay.
They went from having the first pick in the draft to being wherever he's at.
Okay. You got a couple other guys that you're working with, but Joe's really the top guy. Is there another one of the top guys that you're not training that you know that you're really excited to see what happens over the next 2 months then into his rookie year?
Yeah, I'm kind of not training Jordan Love. We are spending a lot of time together, but he's training with the guy he grew up training with for the majority of the time. But I've spent a lot of time with Jordan Love. Didn't know a thing about him leading up until about week 10, week 8 or 9 when I started watching him this year and went back and watched all of his tape. This is an absolute first-round talent. He's got an incredible childhood story of adversity on a level that
tragic,
small few people have dealt with. He was the man of the house at 14. and the way that he's handled adversity. And for me, the way the guys handle adversity is a huge, huge measuring stick for me, because if you have a track record, a proven track record of dealing with adversity well, then that allows me to forecast and predict the inevitability of the adversity you're going to face in the NFL. Because from a fan standpoint, you know, you look at a guy and you go, you know, oh, this guy, he's making millions of dollars. He's, you know, everyone would love to be the starting quarterback, but you have no idea what's going on behind the scenes,
right?
And how low the lows are. Yeah. Right? Money does not solve every problem. And so I look at Jordan Love and I go, man, he is ready for whatever adversity is in front of him, because nothing will equate to what his childhood was. But on top of that, you know, his productivity in college was kind of weird. 2 years ago, he went off. Last year, he threw like 17 picks. But you look at it and you go, this is a first-round quarterback with not a single draftable guy on his team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, coaching staffs get in those situations and they go, they call a play and they go, all right, make it happen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Over and over and over again. They run the same play over and over again all the time there. Like, that's just not what happens in the NFL.
Right.
So I think when he can get on the team, they develop him, his eyes are tied to his feet, he's going through progressions. Because what I've learned in my time with him is his recall is really, really high end.
Yeah.
He can spit things out, he understands it. Reminds me of a little bit of Deshaun Watson and a little bit of Kyle Allen in terms of how confident he is on the board. He'll tell you if he doesn't know something, but he picks things up really quickly. I just think somebody's gonna find, I'm not talking about MVP year two and Super Bowl year three, but he does remind me of Patrick.
Yeah, and that was what I was going to ask. I look at the, you know, like, I remember talking to a team about this, said, watch Jordan Love, because what you'll have is a handful of teams are going to, and they're going to fall for him, right? Mm-hmm. And then they're going to clam up. And it's going to be kind of like this quiet thing where, which I think is exactly what happened with Mahomes. Like, he was sort of a different evaluation, so teams wound up really liking him, and then
somebody had to stand on the table,
and then they shut up about it.
Yep.
And then they got really quiet about it, and so it became like hard to tell who liked him and who didn't like him. Do you see like the Mahomes thing going on, where maybe he's a little bit of a different evaluation, and maybe he's gonna be, some teams are gonna just say, I can work with that.
Yeah I do, and there's some teams who already believe that.
So
I actually think you know, some of the teams that are going to fall in love with him, the people that are falling in love are decision makers. And so those are the ones who don't clam up. It's the position coach, it's the coordinator, it's the area scout, you know.
Right.
But when they're like Andy Reid,
yeah,
he didn't clam up. Yeah. You know what I mean? He knew what he saw.
Yeah.
You know, and Patrick.
So because you have some experience with Tua, would you be nervous drafting him?
Well, I just think the hard part about it is this is gambling, right? The draft is just gambling. And so when you try and mitigate risk versus upside, just like any investment or anything like that, you've got to be able to score both of them, right? Mm-hmm. And the upside is really easy to score on Tua, because he can do some things that I haven't seen people do. His anticipation, how quick he is in the pocket. And almost like when you look at running backs and you go, man, this guy's really short and he's really wide and he's thick. He's got a low center of gravity. Yeah. You like that. Or a D tackle, man, all his weights in his lower half, right? He's going to be good. He's going to be able to anchor down. Domantas Pekko, he's going to be able to anchor down. His lower half's heavier than his upper body. With Tua, he's shorter, which works to his advantage. He's 6 feet tall or whatever he was, but it works to his advantage, and he's thick, and he's so explosive that when he goes to get back on platform or get back in his throwing position, it happens really quick. He's just going to get more high percentage throws because he's quick enough to get set, as opposed to have to throw off his back foot, which most guys do. So you look at the upside. Is the NFL going to be too big for Tua? Absolutely not.
Right.
This dude, it's well documented, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? At high school, he's 11 MVP.
Right.
Those guys are 17 years old, man. That's a big deal, those guys, right? So none of it's going to be too big for him. He'll be able to learn all this stuff. Then you look at the risk side of it, and there is an injury history, and there's this injury now that it's like, well, shoot, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I love the kid. I think he walks into a room and everybody thinks they can win because Tua's on their team, which is worth a lot of money just in itself. But teams are going to have to – that's the one where I think people could climb up, because you just have to be so certain that this injury stuff's behind you, because the number one ability you need to have as a quarterback is availability.
Right. And it's interesting because I went back and I looked at it in the last – I mean, the last 10 years, I said this off the top of the podcast, like the last 10 years, the guys who came in with significant injury history at that position that went in the first round all got hurt again. Mm-hmm. Sam Bradford in 10, Jake Locker in 11, Robert Griffin in 12, Marcus Mariota in 15, Carson Wentz in 16, Deshaun Watson in 17. All have suffered major injuries in the pros, which is...
Wow, that's good at your job. That was like spot on. I'm impressed, yeah.
I mean, so it's that part of it's interesting. Last thing for me then, I do want to look ahead to 2021 a little bit with you. If you were sitting in one of these draft rooms right now and the idea of waiting for Trevor Lawrence came up, what would you say?
Well, I think it's a worthy cause. I mean, you'd have to be really certain that you could get there, and it's so unpredictable. I mean, everybody thought Miami was going to have the number one pick in the draft, and they're picking, five?
Fifth, yeah.
Right? So that changes the whole game, right? I think Trevor's the only guy I've said this about, where I go, people go like, well, how would you describe Trevor Lawrence? I go, perfect, I guess?
Yeah.
I don't know. I have zero concerns with the lack of productivities week 2 through 7, whatever, it doesn't matter. This dude balls.
Yeah.
He's an unbelievable human. He's a great kid.
Yeah.
Wears his faith on his sleeve. Anybody who plays for Dabo Swinney is just going to come out a grown man.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Making their own decisions. It's just how Dabo's doing it now. And he's playing in these giant moments, and he can do all the things. So he's really good. There's a couple really good quarterbacks in next year's class that are kind of under the radar right now.
Well, is there another one that you think's right there with him, or not? Maybe not right there.
Maybe not as high, but I think there's guys who can, who can play. Shane Bichelle at SMU is going to just fly up charts late.
Yeah.
Brady White at Memphis is going to be a guy who's on the radar next year. I think there's a couple of guys that have a chance to make a big splash next year. But you know, Trevor is. I don't know. I mean, Joe had such a crazy year. Trevor will have a much more significant body of work because of like 3 years of it.
Yeah.
He may have 2 national championships, a Heisman, you know, but played in 3.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's that's like it's crazy. You know,
nuts,
people say like Tua won a national championship. He played 40 snaps that year, 42 snaps.
Right.
That's different than what Trevor did, you know? So, Trevor's unique. Trevor's worth, if you're sitting there and you can't get your guy this year, there's a lot of good free agent quarterbacks and, and I think
just
it's
tread
a worthy
water.
Cause. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right. He's Jordan Palmer. Jordan, tell everybody where they can find you. You'll be doing games. Like, this is new, right? Like, so you're kind of changing
your
own deal.
Yeah, I'll be doing games. Basically, I coach in the offseason, so it's really fun. So January, February, March, I've got draft guys, and I've got about 11 vets. Most of them are starters that spend time with me in the offseason. And then April, May, June, July, I run camps around the country. August, I'm doing my QB Summit International. I'm going over to Germany. Going over to Dusseldorf and Cologne, and then going over to Vienna, Austria. We're going to run some camps over there. Football's actually really developed over there.
Yeah.
Outside of Canada. Germany,
so you
got
to be pumped about
most.
That. That's going to be awesome.
Jack, taking my family for a couple weeks. And then start calling games in September. So, you find me on Instagram. I'm an interesting follow. Just my name, Jordan Palmer. Don't spend enough time on Twitter. But, I'm out there and excited. I got whole camps this whole offseason and fired up to work with some young guys.
Awesome. Thanks, Jordan. Always appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, thanks to Jordan for that. Fantastic, as always. We've had him on a lot. He's always great, always gives us insight, has insight now on the number one pick in the draft. He's working with him, and we're going to check in with him again, I'm sure, before we get to draft day. All right, time for the six-pack. We're going old school this week because we are on the road, so it's a little harder to do the setup we normally do with Shelby with our mailbag segment. Those of you who've listened to the pod over the years, you know how this works. We put the call out for question on Twitters. If you've got a question, you send it to me. If I pick your question, I hit that little heart, I give you the like on Twitter, and you get an answer here. We're going to start question number one. This is from Brian Goodwin. That's at Brian22Goodwin. Albert, how is Brady's uncertain future in New England going to impact the team's ability to attract offensive weapons via trade or free agency? Ironic, since these weapons would be for Brady. And this is where the Patriots situation is a little complicated. They're going to have to thread the needle here a little bit because on one side, if they're going to keep Brady, on one side, it's going to be convincing Brady that you're going to put enough around him to put him in a position to compete for a championship. But how can you do that before the league's year starts? You can work out trades. They don't have a ton of draft capital, and they have to get younger. So you'd be committing to doing that. And you'd be making moves that maybe you wouldn't make if you weren't going to have Brady back. And then, you know, you've got to look at the free agent market, and you've got to look like tight ends, Austin Hooper, Hunter Henry, Do you make a play for a receiver? Do you call the Vikings about Stephon Diggs? Do you call the Rams about Robert Woods? Do you call the Browns about Odell Beckham? And so it's sort of complicated here in that if you don't have a commitment from Brady, you're sort of maybe working through these hypotheticals with veteran players where they may not want to come if Brady's not the quarterback, and you may not want them if Brady's not the quarterback, because if Brady's not the quarterback, you may be approaching the offseason in a completely different way. And so the Patriots have a lot of these moving parts that I think are going to make this offseason pretty challenging. Question number two from Chad. That's Chad R. Stowe. How come teams wait until after the draft to hire scouts / front office executives? Seems counter to the practical way of doing things. Plus, the new guys have no investment in the just drafted players. I see this both ways, Chad. On the front end, I understand what you're saying, where the players, you know, there's, and we saw that just happen with the Jets last year. A few years ago, Brandon Bean came into a situation in Buffalo where Doug Whaley had drafted the players. They actually wound up with the Defensive Rookie of the Year that year, and Tre'Davious White. But, you know, Sean McDermott as a coach was very involved in that year's draft. So we've seen this before. You know, I would say the reason why is, number one, January isn't the start of their cycle. You know, their cycle starts in May. And so a year of work, a lot of the work's already done by the time you get to January. And so, you know, you're talking about an entire scouting department working on reports, aligning things, setting up a board, all that different stuff. Then you get a new general manager in there who's got to do new, who's going to do new things and maybe rearrange things and be looking for different things and all of that. And then I think the second piece of it is, of course, because contracts run out in May. And so that part of it logistically makes sense. It also allows a guy to build his own staff. And so he's not working with somebody else's scouts. He's brought in his own, say, college scouting director, his own pro director, his own director of player personnel. He's brought in a lot of his own guys. He's able to go and get some of those guys because their contracts are up, because teams are more willing to let teams go because their draft cycle is over. And so that's the easiest way to answer it. There's no perfect way to do it just because, again, the scouts' calendar doesn't line up with the coach's calendar. Question number three, Redskins coverage, at Redskins coverage, Redskins rumors, draft, free agency, etc. Redskins coverage, I would tell you, I think the team will make a play for a receiver at some point. I'm not sure exactly who that's going to be. I don't know if it'll be trade or free agency, but I do think they'd like to put somebody alongside a really promising young kid they've got in Terry McLaurin. And I think right now I would, you know, put my money on them drafting Chase Young with the second overall pick. Question number four from Funky Donkey. That's at Funky Donkey. For real, what's up with the Kraft investigation from last summer? Ongoing, swept under the rug. What about the Patriots Bengals video investigation? Ongoing, also swept under the rug. I don't think these things have been swept under the rug. With the latter one, I think the video investigation is just, there's no pressing need to finish it now. And so they've worked on that. It'll be interesting to see when we get answers on that. As for the Kraft investigation, I just tell you, this is sort of how they would handle it with a player. I mean, this wasn't a criminal case. You know, really, this is just sort of how we've seen the commissioner handle discipline more recently, where, you know, there's some level of, you know, like internal discussion about it and everything else. But we've seen the commissioner a lot less punitive with players in the more recently. And I think, you know, that's sort of part and parcel to what you've seen there. Question number five from Rick Ignoble. What are the mechanics of draft day trades? Is there a contract? Can there be stipulations and conditions or even penalties added, i.e. letting someone trade up with the conditions they don't draft player X under the penalty of Y? No. And normally these things are done on trust. And a lot of times draft day trades are, you know, worked out where things are conditional, where player X is available. We're going to come and get him. Here was what the terms would be. A lot of that times that stuff has to be worked out beforehand or is worked out beforehand, where when you get to draft night, it's just sort of about pushing it over the goal line. And yeah, I mean, like, there's trust involved between the teams. Definitely. There's definitely some trust. There's a level of trust involved from one team to the next. And that, you know, if you say you're going to do something, you do it. If you say you're not going to take a player, don't take him. Like, there's just, that's like a, you know, a professional relationship thing that I think you'd see in almost any business. Finally, question number six from Touchdown Bucktown 33. What are you hearing on Winston and the Bucks? I think Bruce Arians said it. If they see an upgrade, I think they would look at it. I don't think that, you know, contract negotiations got off on the best foot. or at least the talks there. And so, you know, now I think you have the Bucks sort of looking at all of their options. Phillip Rivers is the one that sort of, he makes some sense just from a scheme standpoint. Brady doesn't make as much sense just like looking at how Bruce Arians' system sets up as, and you know, it's an offense where you're going to take a lot of hits, where you're going to put the ball downfield. That's not really Tom's game. So I could see maybe Rivers winding up there. And, you know, Winston to me, I mean, look, if you're not going to tag him, then, you know, the writing's sort of on the wall. And maybe then Winston winds up in a situation where he goes and latches on with, say, Oakland, and he's competitive, sort of like the situation Ryan Tannehill was in with Marcus Mariota last year, and he's competitive with Derek Carr. And I said Oakland again. I feel like my dad's saying, calling the Colts Baltimore, Las Vegas, where he's competitive with Derek Carr. Appreciate you guys coming out. As always, we want your feedback. We value your feedback. We will apply your feedback to what we do here. You can get to me on social media, my Twitter page, at Albert Breer, Facebook, at Albert R. Breer, Instagram, Albert_Breer. And always remember to listen to both of our podcasts, the MMQB News Podcast, which, you know, if you get out of work someday, you haven't paid attention to what's going on in the NFL, you hit that little button, you get a bite-sized update, everything that's gone on in the NFL in that given day. And then, of course, the MMQB NFL Podcast, which we've got our Monday morning podcast. We've got the Weekside Podcast with Connor and Jenny. Of course, this podcast, the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer. You can get the MMQB NFL Podcast and the MMQB News Podcast on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week. We'll be back home. I'll see you guys then.